Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Session 3 Anti-Money Laundering Developments Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If you require any further assistance, press star zero. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. Thank you. I'd now like to hand the call over to your speakers today, Ms. Jean Bita and Mr. Nikhil Khoury. Please go ahead.
Thank you, operator, and good afternoon, good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. As you know, I'm Jean Bita, and I'm a partner in our financial institutions and white-collar groups, and I spend all of my time representing financial institutions and their officers and directors on compliance and regulatory enforcement matters, especially with respect to Bank Secrecy Act compliance and anti-money laundering. And I'm delighted to be joined by my partner, Nikhil Khoury, who is also in our Financial Services Enforcement and Investigations Group, and he too is based here in Washington, D.C. We'd like to thank you for joining our Financial Services teleconference series, Taking Stock, the Financial Services and Regulatory Landscape Today. And as the operator said, this is our third session in our series, with additional presentations on the Community Reinvestment Act, the FDIC, the CFTC, FinTech, et cetera, to be offered in the weeks to come. So we are really excited to be able to offer this series to our friends and clients. But before we start, there are a couple of housekeeping things I want to mention. First, as to CLE, for those of you interested in CLE credit, today's program has been approved for half an hour credit in New York and California. The affirmation forms were linked in the reminder notice you got for today's call, and you'll need to record the affirmation code that we will share with you toward the end of the call. Then return the form to our colleague, Elizabeth Christiana, whose information is on the form, and then she'll revert in due course with the certificate of attendance. Second, we would be delighted to answer your questions that you have during the program. If any questions come up, please forward them to our colleague, Al McManus, whose email address was on the various confirmations you've received from the firm. And we'll try to answer as many questions as we can, but we'd also like to invite you to reach out directly to Nikhil and me, and you can find our email addresses with our bios at the end of the materials that we circulated. So now let's get going. As you all know, banks have been bombarded with a flurry of issues as they try to respond to this pandemic, including taking care of their own workforces, trying to respond to customers, and most of all, figuring out how to implement the various government programs that have been introduced. But apart from everything else that bankers have needed to worry about, FinCEN and a number of the other enforcement agencies have made clear that financial institutions also need to remember their obligations under the Bank Secrecy Act. And FinCEN has issued two principal public statements regarding the pandemic, one on March 16th and one on April 3rd. And if you read these releases, I think what you'll find is FinCEN is really trying to thread the needle. On the one hand, I think FinCEN is genuinely trying to give financial institutions some relief and indeed make some discrete accommodations to the current pandemic. On the other hand, these releases make clear that these accommodations do not fundamentally change a financial institution's obligation under either the Bank Secrecy Act or the federal anti-money laundering statutes. Specifically, FinCEN has acknowledged that the pandemic creates challenges for AML compliance and that banks could, for example, have delays in the filing of SARs, CTRs, and other reports. And FinCEN has also stated in general terms that it's committed to promoting the success of the CARES Act and that it recognizes the need to facilitate expeditious dispersal of CARES Act funds. But as we'll explain, the kind of relief that it's offered in this regard is somewhat limited. Moreover, in these same releases, FinCEN has made clear that the pandemic itself is a source of potentially heightened AML risk. And so, for example, in its April 3rd statement, FinCEN said that compliance with the BSA remains critical and that FinCEN expects financial institutions to, quote, continue following a risk-based approach and to diligently adhere to their BSA obligations. And you can rest assured that if there are problems down the road, someone will be quoting this language back to institutions that find themselves in the crosshairs of enforcement agencies. Now, in terms of the relief that FinCEN has offered, they basically offered three forms of specific relief. One has to do with beneficial ownership requirements related to stimulus loans. The second has to do with the timing of the filing of BSA reports like SARs and CTRs. And the third has to do with a new FinCEN administrative ruling on CTRs relating to sole proprietorships and some others. But we're going to put those aside for now and just focus first on the beneficial ownership rule and the filing requirements. Nikhil, you want to talk about the beneficial ownership rule?
Sure. Thanks, Jean. So this issue is addressed in FinCEN's April 3rd guidance and in some Q&As that have come out from Treasury since then on April 6th and April 13th. Normally, as I think most of them on the phone will know, under the beneficial ownership rule, financial institutions must identify and verify the identity of the beneficial owners of legal entity customers when those customers open new accounts or obtain extensions of credit. Under the April 3rd guidance, however, when a federally insured depository institution or a credit union extends a loan to an existing customer under the Paycheck Protection Program, the bank or the credit union generally will not need to re-verify beneficial ownership. And I'll come back to an important proviso here in a second. FinCEN's April 3rd guidance was clarified, as I mentioned, in an April 6th Treasury FAQ document. And the FAQ clarified that even where a depository institution has not previously verified beneficial ownership information for an existing customer, and for example, that may occur where the existing customer opened its account before the effective date of the beneficial ownership rule, even in that case, the institution does not need to verify beneficial ownership for that existing customer when extending a Paycheck Protection Program loan. I mentioned that there was an important proviso here to come back to, and the proviso is that an institution does need to verify beneficial ownership information if, and I'm quoting here from the guidance, if otherwise indicated by the lender's risk-based approach to BSA compliance. What that means in practice is a little bit ambiguous. One way to read this is that if a bank's standard AML controls and risk models would flag the customer or the account as suspicious, then the bank needs to do whatever due diligence it normally would do, including with respect to beneficial ownership. So on this reading, the language would just clarify that the exemption from beneficial ownership is limited to that rule and does not suggest any broader exemption from the BSA's requirement to maintain an effective AML framework. But frankly, that's just one possible reading, and FinCEN's intention with that language is unclear. To add to the confusion here, the FAQ document is not fully consistent with the original guidance. Specifically, the FAQ document does not say anything about adopting or having to adopt a risk-based approach when discussing customers who were previously verified under the beneficial ownership rule. And the FAQ document only includes that proviso when discussing borrowers who have never previously had their beneficial ownership information verified. So it's unclear whether this was an intentional change from FinCEN's April 3rd guidance or just an omission in the FAQ document. So that's the proviso on adopting a risk-based approach, and that's one important limitation here. The second limitation, and this is implicit in what we've been saying, but it's that this relief applies only right now to the Paycheck Protection Program. it will be interesting to see if FinCEN expands the relief to the Main Street lending program that is being stood up now. But of course, the beneficiaries of that program are quite different. And so FinCEN's view may be that it's easier for those companies, which are generally going to be larger companies, to provide beneficial ownership information. So we'll have to wait and see. Three final notes on the beneficial ownership rule. First, as FinCEN noted in its April 6th guidance, a pre-existing September 2018 administrative ruling from FinCEN does allow financial institutions not to verify beneficial ownership information when a customer renews, modifies, or extends an existing loan. And so, you know, basically, if there's sort of accommodations being made to borrowers based on cash flow problems they're having during this crisis, it's possible that there's no need to re-verify beneficial ownership information for those accommodations. There's a few conditions on that, the biggest one being that the accommodation should not trigger new underwriting approval. The second point is that where beneficial ownership information is required, FinCEN has acknowledged that there may be reasonable delays in compliance with the beneficial ownership rule. And the last point here is that the Treasury FAQs were updated just on Monday to clarify that the collection of certain beneficial ownership information required under the CARES Act may also satisfy FinCEN's beneficial ownership rule. I won't get too far into the weeds here, but essentially the CARES Act requires the collection of beneficial ownership information on entities and persons that own 20% or more of the shares in an applicant. And basically, if you collect that information and the owners of the applicant are natural persons rather than legal entities, then you are generally going to be able to rely on that information as also satisfying FinCEN's beneficial ownership rule. So let me pause there. I think that covers what we are intending to cover with beneficial ownership, and I'll hand back over to Jean.
Sure. So we just wanted to spend a minute on the relief on the BSA reporting obligations. And basically, both the March 16 and the April 3rd guidance recognize that regulatory timing requirements with respect to these filings could be challenging under the pandemic, and that there may be some, quote, reasonable delays in compliance. However, in issuing this guidance, FinCEN also made clear that it wants financial institutions affected by the pandemic to contact FinCEN and their functional regulator as soon as practicable if they have concerns about delays. So if banks are interested in taking advantage of this flexibility, they should really keep three points in mind. Number one, the delay needs to be reasonable. Number two, the institution should contact FinCEN and their prudential regulator. And number three, the institution should document how and why the pandemic is resulting in these delays. But now maybe we can turn from that to talking about some of the AML risks during the pandemic. Nikhil, do you want to start?
Sure. So Jean mentioned a few minutes ago that FinCEN views the pandemic actually as a source of heightened AML risk, which is one of the reasons that the relief they've granted thus far has been limited. And there's two issues here that we'd like to talk through today. The first is something called disaster fraud, and the second are just risks inherent in rolling out any sort of fast-paced, large-scale loan program like the Paycheck Protection Program. To start with disaster fraud, this is not at all a new concept, and it's been a concern for regulators, dating back to Hurricane Katrina in 2005 and even well before then. In October 2017, FinCEN released an advisory highlighting types of fraud that financial institutions should look out for in the midst of a disaster. And as FinCEN reminded in recent guidance out last month, this 2017 advisory remains kind of a touchstone for the things to look out for in terms of fraud during the pandemic. One of the forms of disaster fraud highlighted in the 2017 guidance is benefits fraud, and that's particularly important here. In prior disasters, financial institutions were at risk from benefits fraud when bad actors sought to deposit or obtain cash derived from emergency assistance programs with the banks. And so these are people who would have applied for emergency assistance and benefits to which they are not entitled, would have then deposited them to banks, and the deposits and subsequent transactions in those funds would have been transactions in the proceeds of unlawful activities. Here, as Jean will address in a second, there is also a more direct risk, which is the risk of fraudulent applications being made directly to banks under the Paycheck Protection Program and the Main Street Lending Program. I won't go through all the other types of disaster fraud in the 2017 guidance, but that guidance is part of the materials that were distributed ahead of this telephone call. And it also discusses issues like cyber fraud schemes, which are particularly relevant today, as Jean will also touch on. So Jean, back to you.
Okay, so thanks, Nikhil. So again, very briefly, in addition to these kind of traditional frauds that bankers are used to seeing, FinCEN has identified a number of emerging trends, and clearly the greatest risk is going to come from fraud committed in submitting these applications or the misuse of stimulus funds. But before we get to that, we wanted to flag these other kinds of activities that bank customers may be engaging in and then using your institution to facilitate their unlawful activity. And while most of these scams may be new to this, it's not the first time that banks have faced extraordinary times, and you know how to respond. Many institutions learned, for example, before the financial crisis, that when there was the mortgage bubble, there were plenty of people out there trying to take advantage of the financial system. But banks are in a much better position today than they were then to detect those schemes on the front end and hopefully prevent them. So the kinds of scams you'll need to worry about are imposter scams where people impersonate government agencies or others to try to get money or credit card information from individuals, investment scams, product scams. But I think what's important to keep in mind is it's not just FinCEN who's focused on this. Similar pronouncements have been released by the FDIC, the CFTC, the FBI, and the New York Department of Financial Services. And those highlighted by DFS include ones that I think are particularly of concern. One has to do with healthcare enrollment scams, where they try to attempt to sell bogus healthcare plans. But also of concern are phishing and other cybersecurity scams, where they somehow, either through a fake COVID-19 website or through a phishing email or whatever, infect the user's malware or introduce ransomware that can only be resolved through the payment of Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency. And then, of course, there's foreclosure rescue scams, where scammers purport to relieve borrowers of their mortgages in distress. But Nikhil, why don't you talk about what happens with the high volume stimulus lending programs?
Sure. So this comes back again to implementing the Paycheck Protection Program and the Main Street Lending Program. And those are both, of course, I think as all of you will well know by now, intermediated lending programs that are run through banks, and so where there's compliance risk for banks. As Jean noted at the outset, none of the recent FinCEN guidance limits the basic obligation banks have to maintain an effective AML program under the Bank Secrecy Act, and that applies as well in rolling out and implementing these programs. So in thinking about the resulting AML risks and challenges associated with the lending programs, we think it's useful to differentiate between two types of risks. First are risks posed by really criminals who are not in need of assistance, but see an opportunity to steal or misdirect funds. And the second is a little more nuanced. These are businesses in genuine need, but who fail to qualify under the specific conditions of a program. And so I think here, for example, of a small business that is really hurting, but its real fear is that it's going to be evicted from its premises, and so it uses PPP funds, Paycheck Protection Program funds, to pay rent rather than paying its employees. So those are kind of the two categories of risks that we think about. And with that set up, Dean's going to speak a little bit more about how to deal with those risks.
Right. So, I mean, the criminals in the first category, namely those who are simply trying to get free money, hopefully banks' AML models are already built to detect those kinds of fraudulent activities. But as Nikhil said, the harder category are those companies who are getting the funds where they're supposed to be used for one purpose, but in fact they're used for another. And as you know, the application forms and the SBA final rule say that if the funds are knowingly used for unauthorized purposes, the federal government may hold the borrower legally liable, such as for charges of fraud. But it's not just the borrowers who are at risk. As we all know, these kinds of situations present very difficult situations for banks. On the one hand, no bank can be expected to monitor every customer's transactions to make sure that the stimulus funds are being used only for permissible purposes. On the other hand, if there are activities that an enforcement agency could say in hindsight was a red flag, then the financial institution could well be held obligated to take action. And as you know, a bank has to file a SAR whenever it knows, suspects, or has reason to suspect that the funds are being used for a prohibited purpose. So not only is there that risk, but if the bank didn't have reasonable controls built in on the front end to identify this potential fraud, the bank could be at risk for an enforcement agency claiming that it failed to maintain a sufficient compliance program as required under the BSA. And in the most extreme circumstances, arguably or potentially there could be liability under the federal criminal money laundering statutes 12 U.S.C. 1956 and 1957. Nikhil, do you want to talk about what banks can do about this?
Sure. So, a number of banks have limited lending under the Paycheck Protection Program, specifically to existing customers. One important observation is that that sort of limit does mitigate the first category of risks, which is lending to criminals, because the existing customers are part of your ongoing KYC and monitoring programs, and so you know who they are. But it doesn't necessarily mitigate the second set of risks that Gene just described. There's the question here, though, about whether following the procedures in the CARES Act, and particularly following the guidance in the interim final rule, which talks about being able to rely on the representations made by a borrower, is going to provide protection or not. I think here there's a technical answer, and then there's a practical answer. The technical answer is that Section 1106H of the CARES Act addresses, is a so-called hold harmless provision. And this is a provision that allows lenders, again, to rely on borrower certifications to determine eligibility and the intended use of loan proceeds. This is important protection, but as set out in the statute, it's protection against enforcement actions and penalties by the Small Business Administration specifically. So it doesn't apply to and it doesn't bind FinCEN. At the same time, following the rules of set out by the Small Business Administration will go a long way toward demonstrating a reasonable compliance approach. But formally speaking, the hold harmless provision does not modify the BSA. and so more may be required, including monitoring to the extent feasible of the uses of Paycheck Protection Funds. I think Gene is now going to speak to a few kind of practical tips about how to set this sort of monitoring up and how to ensure policies and procedures are up to date.
Right. So as Nikhil was saying, we all understand that banks are facing daunting AML risks, both in responding to the pandemic generally and in participating in these stimulus fund programs. So in thinking about this, we think there are five things an institution can do to help mitigate these risks. First, you can continue to apply your existing BSA AML frameworks and modify those systems to the extent you can to take into account these new risks. Second, when you're developing and implementing new processes, for example, in determining which borrowers need beneficial ownership verification or whether to cash government stimulus checks for non-customers, make sure as you're making these policy decisions and putting these operational procedures in place that you're factoring in the AML risk associated with these new processes and recognizing that you're also factoring in a whole bunch of other risks as well. For example, operational, fair lending, other legal requirements, etc. Third, and this is really important, document the decisions you're making and the reasons you're making them. For example, if there are operational limitations that are driving a specific decision, make sure you document that limitation and explain the steps you're taking to mitigate the AML risk. If down the road, once the dust settles and people are doing Monday morning quarterbacking on why an institution did or didn't do something at the time, it's very helpful to the institution's defense to be able to show that the institution thought about it and made a reasonable judgment about what it was doing. Fourth, make sure that your clients and the bankers tell the rest of your employees to not check their common sense at the door. We all learned during the financial crisis when applicants were taking advantage of low doc or no doc loans. You know, and if a house painter came in and claimed an income of $650,000 on a no-doc loan, the loan officer should have been skeptical. And today, by the same token, if somebody is on a PPP application, is providing information, and the information doesn't line up with what you would typically expect of a similar small business, it should raise a red flag. For example, if somebody says they own a corner convenience store, and they have 50 employees, the person receiving that application on the other end should be suspicious, notwithstanding the certification of the applicant to the contrary. Because while the liability in the first instance will be on the borrower, it's entirely possible that an enforcement agency could also look to the bank, saying that the bank was either willfully blind or ignored a red flag. And then fifth, keep the lines of communication open with your primary regulator and, to the extent appropriate, FinCEN. These are all difficult times for banks, but the more your regulators know that you're trying to do the right thing, and the more you keep them apprised of what you're doing and you document those communications, the better shape you'll likely be in, so that when down the road the enforcement agencies forget the pressure that banks were under to get this money out the door, and instead are responding to public pressure around borrowers who exploited the system, there's a serious risk that these enforcement agencies are going to be pointing the fingers at banks and saying, why didn't the banks stop them? And you want to make sure your institution is well positioned to answer that question. Nikhil?
Thanks, Gene. And I think, one quick further point there. There is an online portal for FinCEN to provide them updates on issues like these. And so that's available from the FinCEN website. But more than that, that's a fairly blunt tool. And being able to speak with your supervisory teams directly about these issues is obviously going to be quite valuable and more interactive. So we wanted to conclude, and at this point we have about, I think, 2 minutes worth of content left for those who are keeping track. But before pivoting to that, I realize some people may need to drop at 12:30, so I do want to provide the CLE code. The CLE code is, and I'll, before providing the code, let me say capitalization matters here. The CLE code is capital U, 75, lowercase d. That's capital U, 75, lowercase d. Okay. So to wrap up,
one more thing, Nikhil. When Nikhil says lowercase d, he means d is in dog.
Correct. We wanted to conclude by providing a brief summary of the oversight mechanisms that Congress has established to monitor compliance with the stimulus lending programs that we've been discussing today. In terms of new mechanisms, there are three principal structures that Congress has created. The first is the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, which is a committee of existing inspectors general, and it's been given broad investigatory powers. The second is the Office of the Special Inspector General for Pandemic Recovery. This is an independent oversight body that will be located within the Treasury Department, and it's expected to focus on loans, guarantees, and other investments made by the Secretary of the Treasury under the CARES Act. And both the Accountability Committee and the Office for the Special Inspector General for Pandemic Recovery, both of those agencies have subpoena power and the ability to refer matters to the DOJ for prosecution. There's a more detailed explanation on both of those agencies in the materials that you've been sent in advance of the call. But just to quickly cover the third oversight mechanism here, there's the Congressional Oversight Commission, which is a five-member commission appointed by leadership in the House and the Senate. The commission has the authority to hold hearings, it has investigatory powers, it can take testimony and receive evidence, but it doesn't have the subpoena power, although other House committees, of course, do. There have been a number of controversies about appointments to these committees and commissions. Just to quickly run through these, Glenn Fine, the acting Inspector General for the Department of Defense, was initially slated to chair the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, but the President removed him from his position at the Defense Department, which disqualified him from participating in the committee and from chairing it. There is legislation pending in the House to reinstate him as chair of the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, but it's not clear that that will go anywhere. There has also been some controversy about the appointment of the new Special Inspector General, the appointee is a man named Brian Miller, who has substantial experience in investigations and oversight, but also most recently worked as a lawyer in the White House. And on the congressional side, Senator Schumer nominated a prominent aide to Senator Elizabeth Warren, his name is Bharath Ramamurthy, to the Congressional Oversight Panel, and that's also been a notable pick. At the end of the day, we think it's important to remember that setting aside these political controversies, you know, all of these individuals, whatever their politics, are also professionals and longtime civil servants. And so the specific oversight mechanisms established by the CARES Act, and as an additional point, even if these controversies continued as to the specific oversight mechanisms established by the CARES Act, those oversight mechanisms complement and they don't displace normal course regulation and law enforcement by existing agencies and regulators. So the bottom line is, whatever happens with nominations and these ongoing controversies, the possibility of oversight after the fact oversight here is real. So with that, I think we've gone through what we intended to go through, and we are happy to take questions. Jean, did you want to start?
Well, I think We have a couple of questions here, but in the interest of time, there's one, and then we'll let you guys go. The question is, do you need to file a SAR when a borrower uses funds for purposes different from the permissible purpose, but the purpose is not otherwise criminal? For example, an existing customer uses the money to pay a supplier. And the answer is, it depends. There's no affirmative obligation for banks to audit their customers to make sure they're using the funds for a permissible purpose, like payroll and rent. However, if the bank becomes aware that a borrower is misdirecting the funds, then the prudent course of action is to file a SAR, just like the example I gave before, because otherwise the bank could be accused of turning a blind eye. So, Nikhil,
Thanks, Jean. Yeah. So just to provide the CLE code again, it is U75 lowercase d for dog. So that's capital U75 lowercase d. As mentioned at the start of the program, this is the third of our teleconference series, and we hope you found this valuable and will join us over the next few weeks. Next week, Mike Nanaka and Cody Gaskey will focus on the FDIC's recent rulemakings, including the broker deposit proposal and the ILC parent company proposal. And they'll also bring you up to date on recent FDIC responses to COVID-19. You can find additional information about our financial services teleconference series on the events page of our website. And on our COVID-19 toolkit page. Our website is cov.com, and links are included in the meeting materials. Again, thanks very much for joining us today. If you have questions, please feel free to reach out. You can email Al, you can email Jean or me directly, and our emails are in the materials. Thanks very much.
Stay well, everyone. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.